order.
Yes.
And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2548. Presentation from the Progress Board. We'll start with your presentation. You just introduce yourself to the committee and for the record.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeffrey Tryons. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. You have a number of materials. I've handed out my slides that I will be using, so you should have a copy of that. I've also included the highlights from the most recent Oregon Progress Board report, and you should have a full copy of that as well, which includes an analysis of a lot of the benchmarks in the education area. If you would like another copy or you haven't received one, you just let me know. I would be happy to supply as many copies as you like. I want to just start just giving a very quick history of what the Progress Board is. I know there are a number of new members on the committee that may not be terribly familiar with the board. Progress Board is the agency, state agency, that's responsible for sort of long-term overall strategic planning in Oregon. The original plan was an economic plan that was created in 1989 called Oregon Shines. It was updated in 1997. The Progress Board was also created by an act of the legislature in 1989 to oversee that plan. The board is chaired by the governor, and the legislature reauthorized the Progress Board and made it a permanent part of state government in 1997. One key part of that plan, the key part of that plan, really is education. If you were looking for a marquee to what Oregon Shines is all about, it is this. Oregon will have the best trained and educated workforce in the U.S. by the year 2000 and equal to any in the world by the year 2010. This is all about the economic transformation that's occurring in Oregon and where we need to go in the area of education. What makes Oregon special in having this strategic plan is the benchmarks. We have 92 of them. If you haven't seen them, they're in the back of the report that you have. They start on page 10, and they go for the next about 9 pages. These are all the benchmarks. This is all the data we have on all of them. There is a section on page 12 that is all the benchmarks that relate to education, and these are the ones that I will be reviewing with you in my presentation. The Progress Board assigns a grade every 2 years to how we're doing in relation to the targets that the board sets in consultation with Oregonians and with state agencies. We've had over 7,000 Oregonians involved in this process since it started in 1989, and we work very closely with the agencies on establishing the goals. Overall, and I won't review all these grades with you, but if any of you saw the reports on the grades overall that the Progress Board assigned this time, you'll see that education didn't do too badly, in fact, because the grade overall for the whole plan was a C minus, and we've got a number of A's, B's, and a couple of F's, and I will now review each of these with you. Over here on the right-hand side, you can see the target, where we hope to be in the year 2000. The first benchmark, and we'll kind of follow an age development here, if you will, that we measure is children coming to school ready to learn. We do that through a survey that's administered by the Department of Education every 2 years. It measures 7 characteristics of readiness. What we found when we administered that in 1997 was that 58% of the children who enter all forms of kindergarten, public and private, were ready on all 7 of the characteristics. Now, if you split that out, you'll see that private schools had a much easier time with the kids entering because they had 71% of their kids were judged having all 7 of the characteristics. Public schools were down to 56%. The rest of this chart shows the number of children entering who lacked 1 of the characteristics or 2 or 3. So this gives you a sense that there were very few, in fact, none really, who lacked all the characteristics, but there were quite a few who lacked 1 or 2. the other thing that makes this number a little less worrisome than it might, the 58%, is that the largest characteristic that children lacked was the inability to sit still and pay attention. And as someone who was tied in his chair in the fourth grade because he was unable to sit still at that age, it's not an issue that you can't outgrow and can't continue to learn from. I would just add that from personal experience.
Many sometimes, right?
The next one of the benchmarks we measure is third grade reading and math skills. And here we see, if we look at the third grade math skills, starting in 91, which is when we started measuring under the Education Reform Act, and these skills have been changed to reflect the new standards. So these old numbers are as-if numbers. That is, this is the score if the new standards were in place in 91 and 93. We see a significant and pretty continuous improvement in third grade math skills. We see less improvement, although we do see a steady improvement in eighth grade math skills. Math is an area that's very important for us because part of Oregon's economic change is going to a more technically capable economy, if you will, and that requires knowledge workers, as they're called. This is where Oregon stood in a national assessment that was done in 1996. These are the states that we were the same as, Washington, Wyoming, Utah, et cetera. These are the states we were under, and these are the states that we had higher scores then. So that gives you at least one sense, and there are a number of these that you could look to compare Oregon with other states. But Oregon didn't look too bad. I mean, we were kind of in the middle of the pack, if you will, a little above the middle of the pack, in fact, when we looked at where we stood with math scores in 1996. Now, if you look at third grade reading, you'll see that we saw steady improvement through the early 90s, and then we've kind of leveled off in the last 2 years of that exam. And once again, we see steady but slower improvement for the eighth grade.
Representative Starr?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On this third grade reading, what are you measuring? What's the criteria there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I'm not knowledgeable enough about the test to tell you what's on it, but the number of third graders who achieved the standard that was set, that was essentially the bar, the minimum standard that was required to achieve reading proficiency in the third grade. There is somebody here from the department who can probably specifically answer that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Interestingly, if you look at what's happened with these scores, what I have up here is across the top are the third grade scores and the eighth grade scores, and across the bottom are the third grade math scores and the eighth grade math scores. And then if you look across the bottom at the third grade reading and the eighth grade reading scores, you'll see that both in math and in reading that we saw substantial improvements in the third grade, and we saw less improvement, lower rate of improvement in the eighth grade. The green columns are the children who were in school, those children who have stayed in Oregon schools throughout their time. These are the children who actually sat for the third grade exam. So these are the kids who have been in the system for a while, the 96, 97, and 98 class.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you run any significant analysis on these, any tests of significance on these changes, other than the fact that we have a change here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think clearly on the third grade exams, we see a dramatic increase. So these would be clearly statistically significant change. This is a 100% sample. So what you're seeing is, in fact, the real number. Usually when you look at statistical significance, it's because you're taking a part of a group. I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Well, no, you did understand the question, and you've answered the question. And I do understand the difference between sample, you know, techniques and the whole population. When I look at the eighth grade math scores, mm-hmm. for example, which show something of a of an increased trend, but nothing, and I'm wondering whether there's anything that we can say, even though it's a whole, if we have any tests of whether that is significant. Mm-hmm. Do we have any analysis or comparison, for example, with other states and what their rates of change have been?
I see. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I'm not aware of that, but I would be willing to bet that there are some comparators out there.
Okay. Representative Winters?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, and maybe someone from Ed can take, I have the same question as Representative Jensen, but if you look at, are there any trend lines that suggest that the third grade is going up, and whether that drops after the third grade, or is that decline only in the eighth grade? I mean, where do we go from third grade to eighth grade? Because there's a big period in there, and I'm wondering if you're assessing the whole continuum and why we did just a third and eighth grade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, there is a set of fifth grade scores as well. These are the benchmarks, and what I was specifically asked to talk about were the benchmarks, and I was clear I only had 20 minutes to present this, so I didn't add more information, but there. But we could look at the fifth grade scores, and there is the blanks that you see in here, like for 92 and 1994 for eighth grade math, for instance, they're not blank because the test wasn't administered, but we have to go back and recalculate all those scores because those children, when they sat for the test, the standard was not what it is now. So those calculations, as I understand it, just simply haven't been made, but they could be. And you could look at all the third grade, all the fifth grade, and all the eighth grade, and look at these trends more clearly than I'm able to present this afternoon.
We won't take the questions and answers out of your time, but I am concerned that you're showing an incline in reading scores, and yet we know that fourth grade was below average in the last NAEP test, mm-hmm. the last national test mm-hmm. we had. So how does that harmonize that you're showing third grade on incline and all the way up through eighth grade, but yet we're showing a dip at fourth grade?
Well, the NAEP, Mr. Chair, was actually, I think, in 96. Is that the...
Just done.
Oh, the newest one. Oh, I can't answer that. I mean, it's a question that is broader than my knowledge of how we compare with other states.
We'll leave it.
The point I was about to make is that these green columns are the kids who were in the who sat for the third grade exam and who have now sat for the eighth grade exam. At some point, we should begin to see a more rapid rate of improvement as the children have been through school under this new regime. So there probably aren't enough years really under the belt yet to start to look at that, but that is one of the things that to me would be an indicator that the committee should be looking towards is as we get the system in place and as we get kids moving through the system, those eighth grade scores ought to be improving. You'll notice that in a lot of the areas we've seen significant improvement in the earlier years and less improvement in the last couple of years. I can't explain that, but it's simply an observation that I would make.
Could I pursue a little bit more here, and I don't want to, you know, overburden us with this, but if I'm looking, for example, at the third grade math scores, the third grade math scores for 1991, that should be the same population, basically the same population that took the eighth grade scores in 96.
That's exactly right, Representative Jensen.
Okay, and of course, if I look at that from the third grade in 91 to the eighth grade in 96, I see fairly significant increase or improvement there. But in fact, if I go to the third grade in 93. you know, I see a flat line when we go to the eighth grade. Is that right? Am I reading that correctly?
You are reading that correctly, Mr. Chair. One of the facts that has been gotten some play lately is Oregon's dropout rate. And the way to say this in the most dramatic way, if you will, is as I have on the slide, one ninth grader in four drops out of school prior to graduation. That's what the cumulative dropout rate in Oregon adds up to. So in 1997, 25% of the ninth graders who started school in 93, essentially. I mean, it's not exactly this. This is the way the calculation is made, but this is the result, is that we lose about a quarter of the kids who start school in the ninth grade. If we look at the Hispanic dropout rate, and this is the rate per class per year, if we look at the Hispanic dropout rate, it's about twice the state average. So that's a significant issue that the new superintendent has been actually saying some things about, and it is in my mind an issue for us, not just in the education field but in the social supports area as well, because Oregon has a very high rate of teens who are not in school and who are not working. Those are the kids who end up in the social support system. Those are the kids who will often get in trouble.
Maybe the department will address this as well, but in the 1991 session on the floor of the House, we were guaranteed by Representative Katz that a reform bill would lower the dropout rate significantly. And from your other slide, it appears to me that it's increased.
It's a bit higher than it was in 91, Mr. Chair. I have another slide, which the next slide will show you what really drives the dropout rate, and that's the unemployment rate. If you look at these two graphs, here's the dropout rate for Oregon from 1980 through 1996, and this is the unemployment rate. But when unemployment is high, kids stay in school. When unemployment is low, kids go out and get a job and drop out. And those two lines are very, very strongly correlated.
Reverse negative
correlation. Yes. Right, negative correlation. Yes, I think
Representative Morissette.
Having started teaching in 1961,
Archaeozoic era,
and way back, the dropout rate, that's a very constant figure. In fact, I would say it was even greater then, because I can remember kids telling me that, you know, they're going to go to work for a Weyerhaeuser and they don't need a high school education, mm-hmm. because they're guaranteed a job for life, and mm-hmm. those were their words. So do you go back further? Do you have any data to show that we're probably getting better than we were then?
Well, I don't have pre-1980 data. I don't know if the department does or not, but... but the point of the slide is, in fact, you can't do that anymore. In 1960, it was true in Oregon that you didn't have to have a high school education to have a pretty good career. And there's still a sort of a hangover in certain areas that says, I don't need a high school. I don't need to complete high school. And that's not true anymore. So that's the only point of these slides.
I'm wondering whether you have any data that correlates class size to dropout. I mean, if kids are smaller class size, keep kids more engaged, less likely to drop out. Do we have any studies that deal with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I don't, but I once again, I would assume the department would know a lot more about that than I do. We get the dropout information from the department, so I would have to defer to them.
Representative Jensen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and the dropout rates on Representative of the Chair's comments and perhaps Representative Beck's comments too. The dropout rate it nationally, I think, has declined significantly from what it was, and I remember, without wanting to date myself, but the year that I graduated, my graduating class the dropout rate was 50%, half of the kids were completing school and the other half were not completing school on a somewhat national basis, and I'm not sure what it would have been in Oregon because it wasn't here then, don't have that data. And it has been declining since that time, although we seem to have plateaued, and I want to concur with your observations that both at this level and at the college level, education is a recession industry. That is, the more a recession we happen to be in, the more people are anxious to go to school, sort of thing. So as we look at and analyze and think about these things, I think we do need to keep in mind that the economy and the availability of jobs is going to influence and affect some of that. The additional thing I think we need to keep in mind when we look at and analyze our dropout rates is the increase in Hispanic population in the state of Oregon. And this is not meant to imply that they are not capable of completing high school, but many of them do start with some disadvantages. But even with that, they have the ability to complete without any trouble, I think. The problem is that the culture is somewhat different, and they're more or less on the move sort of thing, such that they may be back in Mexico when they should be in a particular grade moving on. So I don't want us to get overly concerned about that unless we're very careful with what we do with our numbers and statistics.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Representative Jensen, the Progress Board has in fact done a good bit of work on Hispanic student achievement for the governor's office in the last 2 years, and there is a substantial body of knowledge on that. But the fact is, the dropout rate is twice the average. So you're exactly right,
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be interesting to compare the dropout rate statistics with those rates that existed in, let's say, 79, 80, and 81, when we truly did have a recession in Oregon, and see if they're still at 25%. I think I recall when I was on the Excellence for Education study in Salem for 24J, which is now Salem Kaiser School District, that our rates were then at 25%. So I'm not sure that the recession has a lot to do, but it would be interesting to see if that is a correlation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, this actually shows that. If you look at this slide, it starts in 1980. So we see when the recession really hit, which was 81, 82, the unemployment rate went up and the dropout rate went down. The dropout rate didn't go down as much as the unemployment rate went up, but there is clearly a relationship between the two. One of the benchmarks is the number of students who participate in structured work experience. Right now it's limited to the students in professional technical education. It was till 1997, which is the last year we have data. That will be expanded, as I understand it, to include all students soon, if not already. We will be far from the target in this area. The reason for this is because we had some inaccurate information the last time around, which we reported, and the board set a fairly high standard, and then we got new data and the board didn't change the target. So we are making a little progress in that area, but in 1997, only 15% of the students in that area were in what qualified as a structured work experience. Now, the other side of the coin is when we look at adults, we find that Oregon's number of adults who have a high school education at age 25 and older is actually increasing. That's increasing for two reasons. One is because their in-migrants are much more well-educated than long-term residents, so that brings up the number, and because a lot of people go back to community college. We confer about 11,000 GEDs or high school equivalencies on Oregonians every year who realize that they have to go back to school to get an education. So the dropout rate is a social issue as well as an educational issue. We do find that by the time Oregonians get to 25, most of them have returned to school and they've gotten some kind of high school equivalency. And this is true for all racial and ethnic groups, in Oregon. The education levels are improving from 90 through 96. One of our real concerns is the number of Oregonians who have a professional technical education. We have not made any progress. In fact, our last population survey, which the Progress Board administers every 2 years, where we go out and randomly survey 5,000 households, we found that that number hadn't increased at all and might have actually even gone down a bit. So that's an area where the idea college, well, there's a good career out there in the professional technical field, and it seems like we don't have enough Oregonians who are actually in that area. We've seen a sharp increase in the number of Oregonians who have a college education. Who have completed some college. We now know that 62% of Oregonians have at least been to some college, and 29% actually have a college degree or higher. That's up from 23% in 1990. So that's a significant increase in a fairly short period of time. We now have higher levels of education than the national average, and we've been expanding the gap a little bit over the years since about 1970, and we've really increased it quite a bit since 1990. But as I said, much of that increase is fueled by in-migration. We're not graduating any more people from Oregon colleges and universities in 1998 than we did in 1990, private or public. So we had to go back and look pretty carefully to see whether we were just getting wrong answers or whether it could possibly be that in-migration could be upping that number. And what we found was it was mainly due to in-migration. You'll see in 1996 that 42% of all residents who had lived here for 5 years or less had a college degree, whereas the average, the long-term Oregonian, it was 29%. So that's a significantly higher number. We're at or near the U.S. average in advanced degrees in the professional area. We're at 7.0, and the national average is 7.2 percent of adults within the population. Oregonians, here's some more positive news. Oregonians are substantially more literate overall than the U.S. average. We did a literacy survey in 1990. We'll hopefully be redoing that again in 22 when the U.S. literacy survey is administered, and we believe we're about 10 to 15 percentage points higher than the U.S. average on intermediate literacy.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that bothers me when we do these averages with the United States is that there are 50 states, and that this may not have, in essence, much meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I would be much more concerned, or much more impressed, I guess, with our Oregon Shines and our benchmarks if we selected out a group of states. Washington is perhaps an example, Minnesota, Iowa, some states with some common sort of background.
Mm-hmm.
That we would compare ourselves to instead of throwing the whole thing in with Mississippi and Arkansas and Louisiana and so forth. I don't know whether we've done that or whether we haven't, but I would be much more interested in that kind of analysis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, in the new Oregon Shines, for each of the key benchmarks, of which there are 25, we have one section called How Oregon Compares to Others. And whenever we could find a Washington state comparison, when you ask Oregonians, who do you feel that you compare yourselves with most readily? It's Washington State. So we've tried to get Washington State whenever we could. We don't have agreement on what that set of states would be. We sometimes look at the Northwest states. we sometimes look at the Minnesota, Iowa states, and I would really like to get some agreement on what that seven states were, for instance. The city of Portland actually has chosen six cities that they compare themselves with all the time. And if we had that, if we had an agreement on what those states were, we could get a lot more of the data. Sometimes it's just not available. We couldn't do this for literacy because those states didn't participate. Well, a number of those states didn't actually have the state sample. This is only a national survey, which just a handful of states were involved in. But I completely agree with you.
Representative Winters?
Yes, I just have a suggestion that when you update the material,
mm-hmm.
that you change that to van.
Oh,
so it's creative.
Thank you. That's my mistake.
One of the observations that Representative Jensen made poses a kind of a dilemma because we're the only state that does the benchmarks, right? And it's kind of hard to compare to other states that don't really do the same kinds of things that we're doing.
Well, Mr. Chair, we actually, there are about 8 or 9 states that do benchmarks now. Florida has them, North Carolina has them, Minnesota has them, Connecticut has them, Missouri sort of has them. So we could find states that probably had that tracked these measures and we felt were states that we wanted to compare ourselves to or that we wanted to try to emulate. We could do that. It would require some legwork, but it's certainly something we could do. One of the benchmarks is the number of Oregonians who receive some type of skill training during the year. That is employer provided. They go out. They obtain it themselves. We have seen a somewhat of an increase. We only started measuring that in 1994, but we believe this too is one of the keys to us having a workforce that's going to be able to keep up with global competition. And we find that more Oregonians, no surprise here, are using a home computer of some kind. That number has gone up from 50% in 1994 to 60% in 1998. Just want to give you a couple more slides which compare how Oregonians view education to what the benchmarks are showing us. In the K through 12 area, we have a mixed trend, if you will. Student achievement is improving, but we haven't made very much progress on lowering the dropout rate. If you ask Oregonians, which we do as part of the survey that we administer, how good a job is Oregon doing providing K-12 education, you will see that we've got a 7% improvement between 1994 and 1998, and that would be a statistically significant change. So we have seen a small improvement in the way Oregonians view how well Oregon is providing K-12 education. In the workforce area, which is where we kind of throw community college, we see an improving trend here in terms of Oregon's literacy rates and in terms of the number of Oregonians with some college. And we see that Oregonians rank community colleges as the top service Oregon has to offer. And this is, we've asked these questions 3 years, 94, 96, and 98, and every year they're at around 90%. And that is that's the top ranking service that we have in Oregon as far as Oregonians are concerned. In terms of colleges and universities, these slides are a little misleading because, like I said, the rapid increase in the number of Oregonians with college degrees is really from in-migration. It's not the fact that we are generating more college-educated Oregonians in Oregon, but we've seen a positive increase nonetheless. If you ask Oregonians what they think, the number is down 8 points since 1996 and down about 6 points since 1994. So, no, excuse me, 5 points. So we have seen something of a reduction, but you'd have to say that this was actually pretty constant because it's kind of up and down. This is where education falls in the whole range of services that we ask about, which is everything from air and water to healthcare to all government, we see, as I said, we have community colleges as the highest ranked. Four-year colleges is in the middle third. Probably K through 12 would be just at kind of the top of the bottom third. So of the three, you see that there's a significant variance in how Oregonians view how well we're providing these services. And the last slide shows the amount of change that's occurred between 1994 and 1998. So we've seen an improvement in K through 12, pretty constant because they're already so high for community colleges, and a slight reduction for four-year colleges. I've included some other slides which I didn't intend to actually speak about, but they provide you some other information on the benchmarks and state agencies and the factors influencing benchmarks. If at some later date you'd like me to come to talk about that, or you want to just ask me any questions about it, I'd be happy to answer that some other time.
One follow-up question on the benchmarks. Do the other states, do we ask the same questions? Do the states that, does benchmark mean the same thing in these other states as it means in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, absolutely not. We've even ruined the use of the word, because a benchmark usually means the target that you set for yourself when you're trying to improve your indicators. Mm-hmm. And because Oregon chose that word as the indicator itself, and Oregon is the leader, we're viewed as the national, if not the world leader in using these things. It's sort of messed up the language. So we try to go out and talk to people about what they're measuring, what we're measuring. I've always wanted to have the leading states in for a sort of an information sharing. Let's try and get the same indicators so we can compare ourselves. And I was actually invited up to speak to the Washington, the governor's sub-cabinet on quality and his performance. And we've talked some about trying to get some of the indicators matching up.
One other question about how Oregonians rank government services.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to see so many things higher than K through 12 education. I mean, we are talking about K-12 mm-hmm. being the most important, mm-hmm. the most important thing. Well,
yes.
Apparently that is not the way. Now, how did you compile this data?
And we hire a survey research firm, and they actually survey 5,000 households for us. And of those 5,000 households, we call back a randomly chosen 800 of those. And we ask them the opinion questions. The 5,000, we ask demography, how many hours did you work last week, and all that kind of stuff. So this is 800 Oregonians who we ask the very question, how well do you think Oregon, not the Oregon Department of Education or your local school district, but Oregon is handling, or I forget the exact word, is providing, I'm going the wrong way here. I'm sorry, how do you think Oregon is doing a good job of, and then whatever it is, and we've asked this for 6 years now, so we have trend information, and it's pretty consistent. It's not like we get 90% one year and 30% the next. It's the trend lines look pretty good, and so I would pretty much stand by these numbers.
Okay. How recent?
1998.
Okay. And there are no reasons given why people are... You don't ask for reasons?
No. No, we don't.
We don't know why education is rated so low. We couldn't...
No. We couldn't afford to ask. I mean, it's just...
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just an observation. So you were talking about the Hispanic that there was going to be some emphasis, from the governor on that. And I guess I'm very sensitive to inclusiveness. And as I look at your cover from this, it's not inclusive. And you might want to think about, those are just kind of little subtle things that give messages to individuals in our state.
If I might respond, Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, you're not the first person who's pointed it out to me. And I would The reason we chose this cover is because this is the members of the Progress Board from Baker. And they've done a marvelous job out there of sort of energizing their community, and I wanted to honor them by putting them on the cover. And we would have had to fake it to, we would have had to, and I recognize completely that it is a problem, and we will figure out how to solve that. I really like honoring local groups because, they think it's really important, but...
There are two messages, because there's not only those who live in the state, but the state is having a tremendous problem, if you will, in recruiting individuals from across the country. And I know it exists in education, at all levels of our education, and that's a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
We have an image in the state of not being friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it behooves all of us, as we put together our packages, to be sensitive to all of these kinds of issues. And particularly since those are issues that, I've heard not only in our chamber but in others where people are saying, we really do want to be inclusive and we really want to give this message mm-hmm. out. And so that was it just really struck me that to the groups both outside of our state as well as those inside, I would like to see us be a little more sensitive in the messages that we give.
It's a point well taken. If I might just make one other quick comment. When you look at the demography of in-migrants, people who come here look like Oregon as opposed to looking like their state of origin. Mm-hmm. That is to say, most Californians who come here are white. It supports your point, which is that you would think if all other things were equal that the in-migrant streams in California would look like the state of California, not look like Oregon. But that's not the case at all.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator
Beck.
Well, I've just struck by Representative Winter's comment, and I guess I don't know if it's a counter, but maybe just a comment is that at least we're seeing a cover from East the Mountains, which is another part of diversity that I think we lose sight of over here in the Valley and promoting. Covers are symbols for what we're trying to do in this state, highlighting Eastern Oregon and economic development and the need to promote a strong economy in these struggling communities. Even though, granted, a lot of those Eastern Oregon communities are not terribly diverse and not as diverse as communities here in the Valley. So I note some level of diversity on your story, though it's probably more geographic.
Almost half people are women.
I don't want to debate the issue.
No, I just...
We all need to...
Symbols are...
It's a point that I made, Representative.
And I get more beat up from your side than I do from mine, and I'm very sensitive to it.
It's a point well made, and the problem I had with this is they would literally have had to import ringers to make the...
That's not true.
And,
okay,
well,
let's move on.
The Baker Progress Board would have.
Jeff, thank you very much. Is that you in the third row?
No, it's not.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any information related to the in-migration relative to the excelling of the Asian and Pacific Islanders? I know that that is universal or pretty common throughout the country, if not the world. But on our particular data here, is there in-migration information?
We in fact, do a report every 2 years which talks about all the benchmarks that we have data on that relates to race and ethnicity. So we have one from a year and a half ago, which looks at academic achievement by racial and ethnic group. So I would be happy to give that to you or provide to the committee or whatever you'd like to see.
Mr. Chair, I was just curious as far as the in-migration, are Asian children that we are having an impact on, are they ones that are moving in at later stages?
I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question.
Right. I probably didn't. Yeah.
No. I think I just didn't hear it right. I don't. The problem that we have is that because Asian population is so small that we have to go out and oversample to get a sample that's large enough. So we only have a sample of 300. And by the time you pull the in-migrants out of that, you'd have a pretty small group. So I'm not sure we'd be able to say very much. I'd be happy to, you know, by your office and see if we can get an exact question. We can go back and look and see what we can find. What we might be able to do is to group, it would be a rough answer, but if we were to group all of the oversamples that we've done over the 8 years that we have oversamples, then maybe we'd have a large enough one to be able to say something about, you know, the status of in-migrant children. But it would still be hard because we don't know anything about educational attainment of those kids. Probably the Department of Ed would have more information on the kids than we'd be able to get out of the population survey. In fact, I'm sure that's true.
I might follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, with just a comment. I guess it's a frustration of mine, as I think it is of many educators, to try and figure out what the magic is that Asian students seem to excel on every indicator of academic success throughout the country.
I recently went back to school for a year at the Kennedy School, and one of the pieces of common knowledge at the Kennedy School was there were some students who would walk into class the first day, and if there were too many Asians in the class, they wouldn't stay, because they knew they were going to have to work too hard to be able to to get an A. So,
thank you. Hey, Carol Simile Dickinson. Lisa Walker?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're going to come up here to get it.
Joanne, did you want to wait?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I just put my plug in.
Yeah. I wonder if we can put that
back
in a better place.
Thank you, in back.
We're going to see the bottom of that where it is.
Yeah. Go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record, please.
Thank you. I'm Carol Simile Dickinson. And, you know, you've had quite a presentation on some statistics and figures and graphs that were very illustrative, and I'm here as a flesh and blood example of what is going on in the state in education, as is my companion here, Lisa Walker. And Lisa Walker is a student in the K-12 system here in Kaiser, the Salem-Kaiser School District. Well, to start with, I want to tell you about two parents that I know. One of them, when she goes to her child's school, she is well-received and is quite involved in the school, very concerned about her child's education, and the principal, the teachers, acknowledge that this person's child is a high-achieving student and that the parent's involvement probably has a fairly significant contribution to the child's high achievement in school. And the child is well rewarded in the school system. The parent gets many requests to be on committees, to take on school running responsibilities, that type of thing, on a volunteer basis. Now, the other parent I want to tell you about is also very concerned about her child's education, and when she goes to school, she's regarded with a fair amount of contempt. In fact, some have suggested that that parent's involvement in her child's education may, in fact, be a problem in the child's education. Now, that child, I am that parent. By the way, I am both of those parents. I am both of those parents. And I am the parent of two daughters, one who I call my generic child and one who has special labels. In fact, I would have to tell you that her biggest handicapping condition is severe labeling that she has received from being in the public school system for 20 years. She is a very capable, very bright person, works for a hotel company at minimum wage in housekeeping, is still plugging away, earning credits in high school. She has been included in regular classes since she was in the second grade. And I think that's where the mother from hell label was first applied to my forehead, because it took a court decision for my daughter to be able to attend her neighborhood school with her peers who did not have disabilities. And we won, and she completed her education in that environment and thrived in that environment. And the message that she learned and was taught by her teachers and her peers, her classmates, was, if we have to do it, you have to do it. Now, that's a powerful message, because as an adult, now I work with adults who have developmental disabilities, many of whom were raised, lived most of their lives at Fairview. They were taught that they are not capable, should not expect too much of themselves, and will always need a great deal of help. And so when I go to work with them on attaining some basic skills, they have a real hard time unlearning the message that they were taught from infancy. But my daughter wasn't raised in that environment. The message that she learned was, if we have to do it, you have to do it. And by God, she either does it or she tries to do it. Come hell or high water, works real hard. Now, we moved from Washington State to Oregon in 1996, and we did that because my mother, who is here, and this is where I was born and raised, became sick. She had a stroke, and I came to take care of her, and my family came too. So we came for, I would consider, a fairly humanitarian reason. It was certainly never my intent that my daughter subsidize her grandmother's life, quality of life, with her own educational outcome. But in fact, the diploma that my daughter had been working on no longer seemed attainable in Salem Kaiser schools. They told her that she couldn't earn a diploma in Oregon because we have standards and you're retarded and you can't earn a diploma, because diplomas aren't for retarded people. We give retarded people certificates of attainment. A certificate of attainment, folks, in case you're not familiar, is a piece of paper. It's not even seat time. It isn't even a certificate of attendance. It's basically, okay, I'm going to let Lisa talk a little bit about this. Go ahead.
Okay, I got a...
Lisa, give us your name again for the record.
Lisa Walker.
Okay.
I got a something like O'Donnell got... and I don't know what it was for, and I want a real diploma, and I didn't get one. See, all my friends got one, instead of me.
The concern that we have, and the reason we're bringing this to you, is because as you look at reviewing the implementation of education reform in Oregon, I wonder if you're going to consider students with disabilities. Or will you do, as in Salem Kaiser, and say, can I get up? Is that going to cause a problem?
Well, we'll need to continue to hear you, though.
Will this walk with
can
you?
I move this for you? Would that help?
Okay, well, if someone just hands me the chart, I could do it from here. Thank you. Okay, this is data through the Department of Education from 1996-97 school year. There were, in Salem Kaiser schools, this is just one example I pulled out of the huge amounts of data that they provided on these statewide outcomes. There were 1,782 seniors, of whom 1,550, or 87%, were awarded diplomas. Now, within that group of seniors, according to the data, there were 343 seniors with disabilities, people who qualified for special education. Of those 343, 49 were awarded diplomas, or 14%. And of those with the particular label of mental retardation, now remember, mental retardation goes all the way up to about an IQ of 78 all the way down to whatever. So, you know, people could have borderline mental retardation. But anyway, of all the people with mental retardation who were seniors that year, there were 32 of them. Either one, two, three, or four were awarded a diploma. The numbers were so low the department wouldn't actually give me the actual number. They said you might be able to identify the person that way, and then you would know that that was a person with a disability, so therefore we will say it's between 1 and 4, or 3 to 13% of the students with disabilities. Now, I don't know about you, but let's follow this through to its logical conclusion. Are we prepared then to accept a lower class or caste of society, people who can become educated and people who can't? Is that an acceptable outcome? Or do you care that there is a separate lower caste of society being created because school districts are allowed the discretion? The Education Reform Act doesn't require this separation, this inferior status, but it allows it. And if you're going to allow that, then school districts like Salem-Keizer, and Salem-Keizer is the second largest district in the state, have abused that discretion to create a lower caste for students with disabilities. And what Lisa was talking about, her desire to earn a diploma, her desire and abilities to complete coursework in subjects like social studies and math, where in special education there are no standards. There simply are no standards. Now, if you really are not willing to accept a lower caste of society as the result of your work with the Education Reform Act, then might I suggest that you go back and create standards that will work for everyone? Because everyone wants and needs a good outcome from their education. Students with disabilities need a good education at least as much as everyone else. Everything in life is harder for them. Trust me, I know. I walk day to day with these folks. It's harder to get access to literally everything in the community. Not impossible. Believe me, I'm tenacious. My clients are tenacious. We work it through. But it is very difficult. We have all kinds of artificial obstacles in place. Let's not slap them with the biggest whammy of all, which is lack of an educational credential, the lack of any kind of standards behind their educational outcome, which will enable them to acquire a basic level of employment and the symbolism of that basic level of educational attainment. I think it's perhaps an oversight, not an intentional oversight, probably. Nevertheless, it was an oversight that we simply allowed the school districts the discretion of creating this lower caste by not forcing them to include all of the students with disabilities within their educational standards. And let me tell you a little bit about that, because I'm an educator too. I was highly rewarded as a student, and I believed, like a lot of people who were educated in such a way that they thought that students who were highly capable were actually superior. So that when I was majoring in education, I opted not to take special education because I knew that I couldn't, shouldn't, and wouldn't teach those special kids. And then God said, I call this the fire and brimstone diagnosis. God gave me a child like that and said, you will learn to teach this child. And I'm here to tell you, as probably one of the biggest NIMBYs in the room at one point, that we can all do it, that good teaching is good teaching, that small class sizes is the most important point to address when you're talking about facilitating good teaching for all students, and that we certainly have within the Department of Education enough expertise to achieve that outcome. Do we have the will? Do we have the mandate that we must do it? No, we don't. The Department of Education looks at the mandate and says, well, districts are being allowed the opportunity to provide high-quality education to students with disabilities, but they can opt out. I'm asking you to amend it, to review it, to do whatever you need to do to close that. That's an 87% dropout rate, folks. Is that what we want? You're concerned about dropout rates here. I heard it earlier. 87% no outcome at best for certain classes of students. Let's not allow that. Let's develop standards. Standards do not have to be for just the easy students to teach. And believe me, as a teacher, I love the easy students. They're great. They come into your room, you hand them a book, they learn it, you give them a test, they do well. The tough students, the ones that you have to be innovative for, the ones that take more one-on-one, they're tougher to teach. But we can do that too. And we have to allow standards that will be reasonably achievable for all the students so that we don't create this lower class caste.
Okay. Let's pause for questions.
Actually, if you could just clarify one point. Is it your recommendation then that there not be a difference between the diploma and the certificate, that the certificate shouldn't really exist as a separate, as a separate instrument? Or is it your recommendation that the certificate, which you say is presently without standards, should have standards? Is it one or the other of those two things that you're recommending?
Sort of a mixture of the two. What I'm asking is an educational credential awarded that all students be able to expect a credential for their level of achievement, that we don't just sort of say, well, you know, you're 21 now, we're going to... And the other thing that I think is important to remember is that special education is big business. I mean, it's a huge amount of money that flows into the state. I know, it's, what, $4,000 per student. But in math, that's quite a bit of resources. And for the additional resources, we're getting less of a result? I don't think that's very efficacious. I think we should be expecting a better result, or at least as good a result, because of the investment of additional resources. And I'm sorry, people who say, well, but these are really hard to teach folks, you need to come and meet the Lisas and the Sarahs and the people who are in there struggling, working hard, trying to achieve their goals and being told that you can't want that. Don't want that because you can't have that. I'm going to provide you some testimony here. These are affidavits that were presented actually in federal court regarding what we're talking about here. And where's our assistant person? Oh, okay. We're also circulating a petition that says, we, the undersigned, believe that all students with disabilities should be allowed to earn diplomas.
Good. Yes, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand and hear what you're saying at the diploma level and the high school level. How do you feel at the earlier benchmark levels? Do you support and approve and think we should participate in social promotion?
I'm not in favor of any kind of social promotion. What I'm saying is we have to have standards and levels of achievement that are reasonably achievable for every student. The other thing that you've talked about earlier that people were concerned about is that why aren't people going into the trades? You know, why is it that people go to college and aren't going into the trades? Why is that such an undervalued? I think you've created an elitist view of education. If you're capable, you must go to college and into the professions. What's wrong with the trades? Some people like to work with their hands. Just because they're academically capable doesn't mean that they should have to be funneled into a more academic track than be allowed to use their hands. As a college counselor, I worked with people who were going to graduate school saying, well, what I really want to do is be a field biologist. Well, you don't need a graduate degree to be a field biologist. You have plenty of education right now, but because they were academically capable, they had been led to believe that the only thing that was deserving of their investment and energy was another academic degree. I think we need to get away from that, the pejorative interpretation of what it means to be educated and work in, towards a job and work in the trade, and allow for multiple outcomes. The truth is, one of the biggest hang-ups in Salem-Keizer regarding students getting diploma is algebra. They insist that you have to be able to pass algebra in order to get a diploma in Salem-Keizer. And then almost everyone that I mentioned that to says, well, gee, algebra, I never use algebra. Why is that the main requirement for an education?
We're going to have to move on.
Well, that's fine. So by way of answering your question, I guess, I'm not suggesting a lowering of standards. I'm suggesting an increase of standards, applying standards to students with disabilities instead of writing them off. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Kim. Appreciate you being here.
Let me just say also for the record that I have here the petition that you referred to. I didn't leave it on the back table because we can't really have a petition out in our environment here. But you just, for your knowledge, I have it, and if any of you are interested in it, and I don't suppose you'd mind if I made copies of it.
Oh, certainly not.
Anyone's request.
Okay. Thank you. Joanne, could you come up, please? We're running out of time.
For the record, Joanne Flint from the Oregon Department of Education. I have come here today at the request of the chair to share some information on House Bill 2548, and I will do that. I am prepared to answer some of the questions that came up earlier, and perhaps we could do that after I make this presentation, if that's acceptable. The House Bill 2548 suggests that it would be appropriate to have a review of the assessment system and a report back to the legislature. This is something that the department certainly has no difficulty with at all. In fact, I thought what I would do is try and bring you up to date on what kinds of things we have done since the assessment system was put in place, including a few comments about some of the changes that were made in 1995, and then talk to you about the latest recommended changes that are going to the state board for review and possibly adoption on April 22nd, next week. The design of the Oregon assessment system is something actually that began back in the 80s, and quite a bit of work in the 1980s establishing an assessment system that would look at our core academic areas and the performance of students around the state of Oregon, tied directly to the curriculum that we had put in place at that time. Those of you who have been in education probably are familiar with the term Common Curriculum Goals. And these early assessments were program-level assessments that evaluated how well schools were doing in delivering instruction in those program areas. We have had technical evaluations of the assessment system, or we had technical evaluations of the assessment system periodically before 1995. Beginning in 1995, because of some changes that were made during the 95 session, we have increased the level of review. In 1995, we were asked to establish an assessment system that evaluated individual student performance and reported that back to parents, so parents would have information about how their individual child was doing as opposed to how their school building was doing. Since 1995, we've had a panel of national experts, quite well-known people. We could provide those names for you if you like, but they are recognized assessment experts. They have come generally in the fall each year and spend several days reviewing extensively the assessment system. They critique it, they give us advice, and we generally find that advice very helpful in designing the assessment system. In addition, we've had a state advisory group of testing experts from around Oregon, again, since I believe 1989. They meet at least quarterly at some times they met monthly, and they essentially review the testing system from a state perspective as people who are charged with implementing it in local school districts. We have content and assessment panels that are groups of primarily teachers that meet anywhere from 6 to 10 times a year. Those teachers review the test items. They often are involved in the development of test items, and they look at the results of student performance on the tests. These panels have been in place since 1993, but certainly have had a much larger amount of work since the changes in the assessment system in 1995. They are teachers that are extremely well-versed in the content areas. So, for example, you would have elementary teachers that are experts in mathematics. Many of them have degrees in mathematics and have become gone on to get their teaching credential and are teaching at that level right on through high school. And we usually will include a representative from higher education on that panel as well. They are, if you will, the nuts and bolts folks that review our tests. The 21st Century Advisory Committee is a committee that was established in the 1991 legislative action, the Oregon Educational Act for the 21st Century. It is a committee that has a defined membership, including a school board, a member of the local school board, an administrator. Primarily, the representatives are teachers. It's much the same composition of many of our site councils at local school district levels. It also includes parents. We have someone from the Parent Teachers Association on that committee. They meet monthly during the school year, and they review the assessment system as well. They tend to look at it from a more holistic point of view, I guess, in that they will talk a lot about how well-trained teachers are, how curriculum is really being aligned or not being aligned in their school districts. They're kind of a thermometer or barometer for us in local school districts. They come from all over the state and represent both our very small and very large districts. Primarily, those are the regular groups that review the assessment system and have. We have periodically established special study groups in different areas. And in particular, we had a group that began meeting last September, a task force to review the implementation of the Certificate of Initial Mastery. As you'll note from the recommendations that that continue, which I will go over briefly, there were a number of areas that they would like to have further studies conducted in based on experiences they're having in their districts. And so I think this is quite relevant because it does talk about the assessment system. The recommendations include recommendations that would ask the Department of Education to conduct a study in particular areas. In a way, this is a bit like what House Bill 2548 suggests, only in a bit more detail by people who have clearly identified some of the areas they think there may be potential problems, although in some areas they felt they just needed that it would be good for us to just have more information. One of those areas is to study the capacity of school districts to implement the arts and second languages requirements for the Certificate of Initial Mastery and report the results to the State Board of Education. The interest in that area is, as much as anything, I believe, a capacity issue. It really is wanting additional information about how well-trained our teachers are, whether we have enough teachers to instruct in second languages. In the area of the arts, what kind of while that's a local assessment area, in other words, school districts are responsible for determining whether or not students have met standards in the arts. It's an area where we believe that we should have some more information about what kind of assessments are available and how they're working in local districts. The second area is an area that we have had a lot of discussions about at every level in education, and I would suspect that many of you who have contact with schools and or educators have been discussing these things as well. But the department studied the number of work samples that are sufficient to, for students to demonstrate proficiency at 3, 5, 8, and 10, our benchmark years, using that term again, and report the results of the study. We have identified a specific number of work samples, or rather the state board has, that they felt would represent that a student, for example, really did know the math for that grade level and could perform the problems that would be required at that grade level. And that effort to identify specifically how many problems, if you will, a student would need to do and how well a student would need to do is something that there's quite a bit of science about. And we used that science when we established the standards in late 1996. And just as a bit of a reminder, our academic standards were established as a result of changes in the legislation in 1995. So in the summer of 1995, we were directed to establish academic standards. In September and October of 1996, those standards were set by the state board. The number of work samples that are required vary. For example, two writing assignments scored on a common scoring guide using a common consistent measuring scale for students would be what would be required. There has been quite a bit of research done in this area, and the task force recommended that we go back and look at whether or not we have identified the correct number of work samples that it takes to be sure a student can, in fact, do that well. For example, if you had identified that you'd have four math assignments, is that the right number? There is, as I said, a lot of research that's been done in this area, and we believe that it's very possible that we may be able to reduce the number of work samples and still provide concrete, consistent evidence that a student can do that work and is proficient in that area. And that is, in essence, what the study would be about. Now, for those of you who've talked to educators, it's a concern primarily at the elementary school level because, for example, in fifth grade, a teacher may have, while not acting alone, in other words, the work samples can be collected in second grade by students who have done well in assignments as well. It may be that you would have six or seven or eight work samples to collect for one student. And there's a lot of concern that, especially in the fifth grade, that may be quite a burden for teachers to do that. And there is a desire to go back and look and see if in fact, we can find some other ways to really make sure students are in fact, proficient in that area. The State Board of Education is requested to maintain the number of work samples that are required at the current level. In other words, not add any new work samples until we have determined if, in fact, we have the right numbers in writing, in math, in reading. The next recommendation is that the department study whether writing, speaking, and math problem-solving assessments can occur at grades other than 3, 5, 8, and 10. In other words, could we spread these out a bit? And that certainly seems like a good common sense answer and one well worth studying. The Department of Education is asked to align the instructional materials adoption cycle with the Certificate of Initial Mastery implementation schedule. For example, if we were going to require students to take coursework and have an opportunity to meet the Certificate of Initial Mastery in Science in a given year, and school districts, because of the 7-year textbook adoption cycle, were scheduled to adopt textbooks a year after students were to be held accountable for science standards, that certainly would not make good sense. And as a result, the Department of Education is working now. We have contracts with those textbook publishers, and we're working now to align those contracts so that, in fact, we have a system that is fully aligned. That is an area we've actually been working on for a while. We've certainly increased our efforts in that area to the extent of putting some legal language in our documents that went out, allowing us more flexibility in those contracts. And that is a statutory requirement, so we believe that we will try during the next year or so to handle this through our contracts, and if we run into problems, we may need to come back in the next session with the recommendation. The next recommendation is that the department communicate decisions about the implementation of the Certificate of Initial Mastery to school districts no later than May. This is an area where we certainly believe we could have done a better job. It has occurred on occasion that we have sent information out to school districts in September or October, for example, in areas where we're going to require something to be done in February or March or April for the assessment, and that is not adequate notice for schools that do the majority of their planning during the summertime and prior to school starting. And so this is, in essence, a commitment to ensure that they have adequate notice and an opportunity to really prepare fully for the next school year. The State Board of Education, this is the final one, the one that probably gets the most press. The State Board of Education reset the timeline for phasing in science and social studies, essentially setting the timeline out for student accountability. And that's important to realize. In other words, for students taking a test in science and in social studies, we would not have, for example, a test next spring. We would have the test for students in science in 2000, spring of 2003, 2002, 2003 school year. It's a three-year adjustment, and we believe that that adjustment is necessary because the school districts that were represented by the task force and by people who gave feedback to those on the task force felt that, in fact, the standards for science had been set. Not all of the assessment information was available, all of the testing information was available in a timely enough fashion to give school districts a chance to align their curriculums, to ensure that they, in fact, were teaching and had materials available to teach to the standards. And in addition to that, many of our teachers, particularly at the elementary level, do not have very strong backgrounds in science. And they are going to need some additional training in this area. School districts felt they could do it, but they felt that it was going to take longer to assure that every child who's being tested in science as a teacher who knows that science and who has had a chance to teach that science to them. And that is essentially the recommendation. We have had a strong interest in maintaining the quality of our assessment program, and it is, as you know from lots of stories that float all over the place, very, very difficult to do. But we've been proud of our assessment system thus far. We have been able to work with educators around the state to develop good quality assessment systems. We believe we are there and doing very well in English and mathematics. We need more time in science and social studies to assure the same quality. And this does not mean that we would not have the tests. It just means that we wouldn't hold students accountable on those tests until we have given them an adequate opportunity to learn. It's a little bit like the way we've always done graduation requirements. We always gave four-year notice. You didn't have the graduation requirements change your junior year of high school. You changed the graduation requirements 4 years out so that students who are coming into high school know what's expected of them when they finish high school. And that's pretty much what we're asking the state board to do. These recommendations were taken to them in March, and they will have them again in April for a vote. They'll look at each of these different study areas and the recommendations and make a decision, I suspect, in April. I'll take any questions now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Thanks. I'm getting a lot of unilateral concern from, or unilateral input from teachers about the tests. I'm sure you guys are all aware of this. I mean, I've never, what's interesting to me about all the education issues, everybody's an expert and everybody's got their own approach. Everybody's been through school. So the result is everybody thinks they, you know, it's all 9 members, 10 members of a committee or parents or kids. Everybody's got their own way of what works. So I was struck to be in a room of 20 teachers, mostly metro area teachers, young teachers mostly, people who've gotten into teaching because of this type of rigor, these new standards, the rigor, the challenges. That's why they got into teaching. But they're telling me the same thing. We are being forced to teach to these tests. Something's not working. And I say, are you want to get rid of the sim? No, we aren't chickens. We just something's wrong. And some of them will say it's classes are too big, and some will say the tests aren't quite right, and some will say they haven't been trained well enough. Some will say they've got spending too much time with portfolios and not enough time teaching. So it's some of all of the above, but they're all saying these tests are problematic for us as teachers. What do we do? Do you have other advice about how we should be proceeding or what sorts of questions we should be asking along the lines of something you guys are already doing, but other than just extending the time frame, is it just class size? Is it some specific training that is not happening that should be? Are the teachers whining about something? They're just whining about change? Blah, blah, blah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I'll suggest to you, and I'd love you to tell me if this isn't the case, but I'd suggest to you that probably most of those concerns are related to the science and the social studies tests. Is that
mostly social studies, these teachers were, but yeah, science too.
The reason that we're looking at postponing this is we've just given a pilot in the social studies pilot test. And one of the ways that we have good quality tests in this state is we involve educators in the process. Now, we could not do this. In other words, we could not pilot the tests. Now, students don't get the results back individually. They don't on these pilots. They do not get information about you're here and you should be here. On the pilot tests, it's an opportunity for us to develop together the test. I believe we've not done a very good job of communicating that through the course of this last year, and we're suffering the results, and it's largely a communication issue. The quality of the tests is something that we're all concerned about, and I will tell you that they will be better, much, much better, for all of the concern of educators this spring. In fact, we've been discussing how we're going to systematically collect all that feedback from the tests. There are, in fact, a number of items that we really were not terribly satisfied with from the contractor. But we are struggling to ensure that we have a good quality test. Now, there would be another option, and that would be to simply buy a test from someone. If you bought a test from someone, you'd have no way of knowing whether that test reflected anything you'd taught. And I can tell you from having bought some of those tests and looked at them personally out of curiosity that they have a number of the same kind of items on them that our social studies teachers are complaining about. We are convinced that we can write good quality tests because we've done that historically in this state, and that the general support for our tests in English and mathematics are an indication of really being able to do the job when we have time well. We began working on the tests in English back in the early 90s. We began working on the math tests in 92 or 93. So we had quite a bit of lead time before this spring, 98, 99, when they're essentially ready to go and people are feeling like, yeah, I've had a chance to teach that. I understand it. I do want my kids to know this. It becomes less of an issue of teaching to the test if that's what you've taught in your class and you expect your kids to know it. Then it doesn't feel like it's teaching to the test. It's kids know what they're supposed to know. So I think we are at a point with the science and social studies where we have got to say we're not satisfied with the quality. Science is fairly close. I suspect there are considerably fewer concerns about that, but still a few. And we're not holding students accountable. We have an opportunity to go another year, and then we will, in the social studies, continue to improve the quality of that with good feedback from all teachers. And if we were talking about the possibility of having teachers sit down and critique the test and give us an idea of which items were good and which items were not following the testing period so that we really could get some extensive feedback from the teachers as opposed to what we often do, which is the content and assessment panel or a small group of people come in and then everyone goes, well, I don't think they really were paying attention to what I had to say. So it is an issue that needs to be attended to, and it's a commitment we've made in creating our own tests that are keyed toward Oregon standards.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joanne, there's been some discussion and confusion, I know, in Salem respecting testing, that we're having too many, too much, particularly where you're doing both the testing for the SIM as well as the testing for the Iowa test. And so, you know, the teachers are saying, you know, we're doing nothing but testing. Will there become a point where this will be reduced so that there isn't that much time that's devoted to just testing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, I certainly hope so. I believe that Salem-Keizer has a long history with that test, and they wanted to do a couple of things, develop a history with the state assessment so they had the same kind of longitudinal data. I believe they're getting close to having that. I believe they also were concerned about national norming, and we now have the ability to do some really excellent national and international norming with our tests, and I think that probably that will allow them to back off of that. In addition, they used those tests for quite a while to identify students who were eligible for federal funds, Title I programs, and that is not something that they need to do any longer. So I hope we're close to the end on that one.
Clarification, are we the only district that's doing multiple tests?
One of very few. I don't know how many actually are left, but there are very, very few.
Representative Morsat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former social studies teacher, I spent a lot of time on my multiple choice test and testing the different, you know, a four-part question and getting rid of the ones that were not effective, and I know how difficult it is to construct a good test. And I've used tests that came with the text and found them usually unsatisfactory. I mean, so I understand the difficulty of testing, and it's an ongoing kind of thing that has to be done. So, and I think it's a good idea that you do involve teachers, and I appreciate that.
Okay. No further questions? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2548. And before we adjourn, I want to alert the committee one more time that starting next week, our sessions will be from 1 to 4. And we are adjourned.
We'll answer any questions about dropout rates.
If you would like to make those written instead of